This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Town at the Edge of Darkness, The XCOMs, Book 2. Written by Brett Battles. Performed by Allison Johnson.
1. June 2014.
Hang back! Hang back!
Dalton Slater said. Two of the young men who worked for him stepped in front of the trial participants to make sure the hunters held their ground while the boss checked the prey. A headshot just below the cheek. That didn't always guarantee a kill, but in this case, the bullet had done more than enough damage on the way out to seal the deal. A second shot had caught the prey in the chest, a little high to hit the heart, but the clients wouldn't know that. Slater turned back to the others and smiled.
Great job, gentlemen. 2 kill shots.
Which of us was first? Asked one of the participants. He had been designated Mr. Grant for the weekend. Slater shrugged.
You shot pretty much at the same time, so you were both first.
Mine was the headshot, Mr. Van Buren said. Slater and the other organizers had gone for a president's theme on this, the inaugural gathering of the trials.
Hold on, Mr. Grant said. I'm pretty sure the headshot was mine.
They were both wrong, but instead of saying anything, Slater caught the eye of his daughter Monica, using the name Miss Roosevelt this weekend, and gave her a subtle nod. She said, Gentlemen, the observer has declared a shared kill. The trials are over. It's time to join the other participants and celebrate the conclusion. As had been the case since the start of the festivities 3 days before, Monica had them eating out of her hand. With the appropriate amount of grumbling, they nodded their assent and followed her back to the lodge. As soon as they were out of earshot, Slater nodded at the prey and said to his boys,
Get it out of here and make sure everything is nice and pretty.
Yes, sir.
Slater rode his ATV back to the lodge and entered the large kitchen. A few of the others he'd recruited into the organization, a trio of teen boys and 2 men in their 20s, were putting the finishing touches on the closing banquet. Each took time to acknowledge Slater with a,
Hello, sir,
or a, Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon, gentlemen,
he replied as he crossed the room. In the back hallway, he stopped at the basement entrance, punched in the code, and opened the door. His brother and their cousin were waiting for Slater in the central room below.
They finally got the son of a bitch, huh?
His brother said.
Took them long enough.
They didn't get him,
Slater smirked. Jerry did.
What?
His cousin said.
Did you want them to keep going all night? Because that's what would have happened. Those 2 idiots couldn't hit a tree if they were standing in the middle of the woods. Finally had Jerry hide out of sight and put the prey down with a double tap, head and chest.
Damn, Dalton,
the cousin said.
What if they'd have figured it out? They could have demanded their money back. Think what would have happened if they spread that around. We'd be ruined just as we're starting.
We talked about this, remember?
Slater's brother said.
Dalt was just following procedure.
Procedure you 2 came up with. I had no part of that, as I recall.
Because you were too busy to meet with us, as I recall, and a decision had to be made.
Slater said,
Relax. No reason for anyone to get worked up. It worked, okay? They're happy. They'll tell their friends about this, and pretty soon we're going to be turning people away.
We'd better be,
his cousin said.
We will, I guarantee it.
Not only was Slater proven right, but business picked up so much that instead of quarterly events, they started holding the trials every other month, and then, in 2017, every month. 2. Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. Tasha Patterson mouthed a silent, Thank God, as the portal to the company's cloud storage servers appeared on the screen. She was using the computer in the mobile office at the Scalarian Solar Farm construction site north of Bradbury at night when no one else would be around. Until that very moment, she'd been unsure if this particular machine was authorized to connect to that part of the system. If it hadn't been, she would have been forced to attempt the riskier route of using a computer at company headquarters back in Bradbury. Getting into the cloud was only one step, however. She still needed to locate and access the hidden files. She glanced at the paper she'd set next to the keyboard, on which she'd written a list of drive locations she thought would be the most logical places to find the files. They had to be there somewhere. The one she'd stumbled upon couldn't be the only document. Its discovery had prompted this insane mission to investigate further. The file was a simple transportation log and had looked innocent enough at first. But on closer examination, it matched none of the company's records. Whoever controlled the document had apparently discovered their mistake, because when she tried to pull it up again the next day, it had disappeared. Thankfully, she'd made a copy. She always made a copy. Still unsure of what she'd found, she'd asked one of her employees to look into the discrepancies. 2 days later, before he reported back, she received his emailed resignation. An opportunity had come up with a company in Shanghai, he'd written, and he'd had to leave right away. She tried contacting him, but he never returned her call. She would have called the company he went to work for, but he hadn't named it. Though he had talked about wanting to work abroad someday, Tasha felt sure he would have told her first, in person. Over the next couple of days, her thoughts transitioned from confusion to wondering if his inquiries on her behalf had been met with a get-out-of-town-now ultimatum. Maybe she was reading too many thriller novels. Whatever the case, his abrupt departure made her reluctant to bring anyone else into her private investigation. The most she allowed herself were a few cryptic emails to her mentor and former employer, Scott Davos, in California. Until she had concrete evidence, she was keeping the bulk of her suspicions to herself. She logged into the cloud using the still-active username and password of her China-relocated ex-employee and brought up the directory. She had whittled down her list to 4 possible areas where the files could be hidden. Back at her office, she hadn't dared probe any of the areas. Now she dove in, searching for anything that shouldn't be there. The first 2 areas proved to be dead ends, and she couldn't help thinking the files had been removed. "Or you've been wrong all this time," her subconscious suggested, "and you've been seeing shadows where there were none." God, she hoped that was true. She would love nothing more than to prove her suspicions were completely groundless and that someone on the inside wasn't trying to skim product from the company. As she accessed the third area, however, she came up against a firewall that shouldn't have been there. One of Davos's many imprints on Tasha's life was the importance of understanding everything, as in all parts of the businesses she worked for. Because of her adherence to this philosophy, she'd been continually promoted until, with the recommendation and blessing of Davos, she landed her current CFO position at Scholarion Inc. in Bradbury, Washington. So, even though her area of expertise was finance, she had studied information technology on the job, and knew as much about IT as many of those who worked in the field. She searched the firewall for a weakness, and when she found one, slipped through the gap utilizing a trick she'd learned from a Davos coder. On the screen was a log of hundreds of files that should have been there. She opened a spreadsheet document and immediately recognized strings of characters almost identical to the ones she'd written in her notebook at home. It contained information she'd scrounged up over the last few weeks that she thought might be connected. Somewhere within this set of files must be the proof she'd been looking for. She would figure out who was involved and the monetary damage they'd done to Scholarion, and then present everything to the CEO and President Kyle Scudder. She scrolled through the list and was surprised to find a group of photographs. Could the embezzlers have possibly been stupid enough to take pictures of themselves? It would definitely be a nice shortcut. She opened the first 4 images. Her elation about possibly uncovering proof of her suspicions turned instantly to revulsion. Criminal activity had been going on, but it wasn't being committed by rogue employees stealing solar panels. What the pictures showed was so much worse and more repugnant than her imagination could have dreamt up. For a horrified moment, she could do nothing but stare at the monitor. When she finally closed the files, she glanced over her shoulder, half expecting to find someone holding a gun to her head, but the trailer was still empty. She plugged one of her jump drives into the computer and began copying everything onto it. There were a lot of files, but the trailer office had a decent satellite connection, and in a little over 7 minutes, the task was completed. She inserted a second jump drive into another slot and started duplicating everything from the first drive onto it. With 2 sets of documents, she could keep one and send the other to Davos in case something happened to her or her drive. The display said it would take 4 minutes. She paced the trailer, glancing nervously out each window she passed. The moonless night offered little for her to see beyond the outline of the forest around the edge of the clearing. Each time she passed the computer, she checked the copy status bar. 3 minutes. 2. 1. A light on the desk phone blinked. No ring, just the glow for line 1. She took a few deep breaths to try to calm herself. It didn't work. The call could have been nothing more than someone wanting to leave a message, but she couldn't help thinking IT had registered the computer's activity. "It's okay," she whispered. The construction site was nearly 30 minutes north of Bradbury. If the company sent someone to check, she'd be long gone by then. The final seconds of the file copy countdown seemed to last forever. When the status bar hit zero, a voice in her head screamed at her to get out of there, but she needed to do one last thing. With shaking hands, she opened the browser in incognito mode, brought up Gmail, and created an email account. In another window, she found the contact information for Darren Gaines, the U.S. attorney in charge of this part of the state, and copied his address onto the message. Sending him everything would take way too long, so she attached the first document she'd found and two of the JPEGs, wrote, "This is just a start," as the subject title, and hit send. She snatched the two thumb drives, stuffed them in her pocket, closed the browser, and put the computer back to sleep. After scanning the desk to make sure everything looked as it had when she arrived, she headed for the door. The construction site was half a mile from the main dirt road, which was at least a mile from the highway. When she stepped outside, she expected to hear only a gentle wind blowing through the trees, maybe an owl at most. What she didn't expect was the drone of a car's engine. The vehicle wasn't close, but it did sound as if it was coming from the construction site access road. It can't be someone from the company already, can it? How could they have gotten here so fast? She had to get out of there. The problem was that the access road was the only way in and out, so if the other vehicle was on it, she was already as good as discovered. Wait. When she'd taken the management tour of the site, she had noted a few old overgrown roads leading into the woods from the access road. If she could find one of them before the incoming car saw her, she could hide, and while it went on to the trailer, she could escape. She jumped into her Prius and took off for the gate, leaving her lights off. She'd left the gate open when she arrived, so she raced through and onto the road. She figured the others, if they were indeed coming for her, already knew someone was out here. If they found an open gate, they might approach with caution, slowing and giving her even more time to get away. Eyes glued to the road, she drove as fast as she dared through the darkness. The flash of headlights ahead caused her gaze to jerk up. It had shown through a momentary, perfect alignment of gaps between trees, confirming the other car was heading her way. "Come on, come on, come on," she said, willing her escape route to show itself. Despite her vigilance, the old road was so overgrown she almost missed it. When she realized it was there, she whipped the wheel to the right and pressed the accelerator enough to help the vehicle up a small incline. "Just a bit farther," she thought. "Another 30." The car lurched to the left. Out of instinct, her foot shoved the brake pedal, bathing the trees behind her in red light. She yanked her foot away, returning the vehicle to darkness. Whatever had pulled the Prius to the side had also stopped it. Breathing deeply, she killed the engine, and after making sure the dome light was off, opened the door and listened. She could hear the other vehicle loud and clear now. Leaning outside, she looked back the way she'd come. Headlights, not a quick burst like before, but a series of blinks between trees, were no more than 50 feet from the end of the old road. Had the driver seen her brake lights? Subconsciously, her hand slipped into her pocket and caressed the drives as if they were talismans that would turn her and her car invisible. The lights moved closer and closer. Tasha eased one foot out the door, ready to run if the other car turned toward her. Another blink, and then the car drove past the old road without stopping or turning. She let out her breath and listened to the engine move farther and farther away. When it became a distant rumble, she climbed out to search ahead for a place to turn around without having to reverse. She quickly discovered that wasn't an option. The front left wheel had fallen into a channel that grew deeper and wider the farther ahead it went. If she were to continue in that direction, she'd become permanently stuck within a few feet. Reversing was her only choice. She knew it was possible to remove the bulbs in the reverse light, but figuring it out would take time she didn't have. Instead, she draped a blanket from her cargo area over the back of the car, tucking the top and sides in around the hatch before she closed it. The extra bulk made it hard for the lock to catch, but after a few tries, she got the hatch closed. Back behind the wheel, she muttered a prayer as she shifted into reverse, using her side mirror to back down the road, because the blanket prevented her from seeing through the rear window. Much to her surprise, she made it unscathed, and by the look of things, undetected. As fast as she could safely go, she headed for the dirt road that would take her back to the highway. Her tuck job at the back hadn't been as perfect as she'd hoped, and the blanket flapped. But the glimpses of the road in her rearview mirror showed no lights heading her way. When she felt there were enough trees between her and the construction site, she flipped on her headlights and pushed the pedal to the floor. She was going to make it. She was going to get out of this, with the proof. Those bastards, whoever they were, would go down, hard. As she came out of the final bend, she slammed on her brakes. A sedan sat diagonally across the end of the access road, and not just any sedan, a Scalarian security vehicle with two men in front. There was a moment when neither Tasha nor the men did anything. She had no idea what they were thinking, but knew she had a choice. It was possible security knew nothing about the crime she'd uncovered, meaning they would help her. But what if they were well aware of the issue, or even involved? For now, she knew trusting anyone who worked for Scalarian would be a mistake. Putting the Prius in reverse, she looked back. Damn it! She'd forgotten about the blanket. She switched her gaze to the side mirror and raced backward as best she could. For the first 50 feet, she did fine, but she made the mistake of glancing forward to check on the security car. When she returned her eyes to the mirror, she misjudged her position and swerved the car back toward the center of the road, but she overcorrected, and the car rocked as the passenger side drifted off the shoulder and swiped a tree. She jerked the wheel, angling the Prius's back end toward the center of the road, but before she could straighten again, the front passenger fender smashed into the same trunk, stopping her. Ahead, the security sedan was driving toward her. Tasha didn't waste any time trying to see if she could get the car back on the road. She gunned it forward toward a wide spot between the trees, hoping there would be enough room to weave her way through. Of course there wasn't, and the natural trail lasted no more than 40 yards before a tree seemed to jump in front of her. She slammed on the brakes, but the tree was too close, and the Prius smashed into the trunk. The airbag ejected from the steering wheel, knocking her back against her seat, stunning her. "Get out!" Her hand pawed at the door, taking what seemed like forever to find the handle. When it did, she yanked the lever back and shoved the door open. Her car's headlights were still on, bouncing off the trees. The pine she struck tilted away from her at an angle, not enough to fall, but it wouldn't take much for it to do so. "Go, go!" She stumbled out of the cab.
"Hey! Hey, you! Stay right there!"
The security car was parked at the spot where she'd left the road, and the officers who'd been in it were now outside, one standing near the front end, pointing at her, the other already running in her direction. She shot into the woods, having no destination in mind except anywhere but where she was. The guard shouted again, but she didn't even try to understand him. The highway, she thought. If she could get there, she could flag down another driver. Though it was at least a mile away, getting there was the only chance she had of evading capture. She turned what she hoped was westward and ran like she hadn't run since high school, leaping over bushes she saw and smashing through those she didn't. She hoped her course correction would throw off the guards. But when she glanced back, she spotted flashlight beams bobbing among the trees heading her way. The forest seemed to go on forever, and soon she lost all sense of how long she had been running. 10 minutes? 15? However long, the highway had to be coming up soon. After she cut through a slot between two trees and raced down and up a narrow ravine, she heard something that nearly stopped her in her tracks, a rumble that sounded like an engine. She raced toward the noise, and within a few seconds caught a glimpse of headlights ahead to the right. Her moment of joy was tempered, however, by the cracking of a branch somewhere behind her and the sound of running steps closer than before. The Scalarian security guards must have heard the engine, too, and they knew they would lose her if she reached the highway. As the headlights sped past, a second set appeared. Judging by its speed, the car would also be gone before she reached the highway. She scanned left and right, hoping to spot other cars, but either the trees were blocking them or there were no others at the moment. Her panic increased. If she reached the highway but found no vehicles to flag down, the men chasing her would still nab her. "Rig the game in your favor," Davos had preached over and over. "If you control the options, you control the ultimate outcome." But how could she control this outcome? She couldn't keep running all the way back to Bradbury. Her hand brushed against her pants, catching on the jump drives in her pocket. Not this outcome, the ultimate outcome. Maybe she couldn't get away right now, but she could give herself a fighting chance later. She looked around for a landmark she could remember, and after several seconds spotted a dead tree leaning at an angle against two live ones. "Near the highway, west of the access road, leaning dead tree." She could remember that. She repeated the location a few more times to commit it to memory as she pulled out one of the drives and angled toward the three trees. When she was positive she was out of sight of her pursuers, she paused just long enough to stuff the jump drive into a split in the wood and then resumed running. She saw another distant set of headlights and knew this time she would reach the road in time. The only question was whether the car would arrive before the guards did. She channeled her remaining energy into an all-out sprint. Almost there! Almost there! Almost! 20 feet shy of the forest's edge, hands latched onto her shoulders and pulled her back. Her feet flew out from under her and she fell, landing first on her hip and then flopping onto her back, her head bouncing off the ground like a basketball. She lay on a bed of needles, dazed and gasping for air. Gray hovered at the edges of her vision, threatening to drag her into unconsciousness. A foot jabbed her in the ribs.
Nice try, bitch!
Her brow creased as she tried to focus. The fuzzy form of a man looked down at her. Another couple of blinks, and she could make out his face in security uniform. She didn't recognize him, but that didn't mean anything. She could have passed him a million times at the office and never really seen him. He seemed to be talking into his hand, but her brain couldn't untangle what he was saying. Another voice, this one altered like coming out of a TV, and then the guard again.
Roger.
Was that his name, or the name of the man he was talking to? She tried to sit up, but the man shoved her back down.
Better if you stay right there, Miss Patterson.
She closed her eyes, the fog in her head clearing at a glacial rate. She was aware enough, however, to realize he'd recognized her. When she opened her eyes again, the guard who tackled her had become two men. She blinked, thinking one would vanish, and then realized the second man was not a clone of the first. This man she knew. Leonard Yates, Scholarian's head of security. He knelt beside her, looking disappointed.
Well, well, Miss Patterson, you are a long way from the office.
She pressed her lips together.
Yeah, I wouldn't say anything either.
He grinned.
You're a tricky one, you know that? Coming all the way out here to get onto the network. That was unexpected. You don't mind if I pat you down, do you?
She kept her expression as blank as she could manage, but it was no easy task. Though he hadn't said it directly, he'd implied he knew why she was out here, which meant he was one of them.
No objection, he said. Good.
He removed her shoes and pulled out the soles. He then moved his hands up her pant legs to her hips, tapping his palms over her pockets. All very professional, with no hint of inappropriate intentions. He moved on to her shoulders, the sleeves of her light jacket, and the jacket's pockets. That's where he paused.
What do we have here?
He reached inside and pulled out the jump drive.
Oh, Miss Patterson, I gotta tell you, this does not look good. If this has on it what I think it does, you're in some pretty deep shit.
Like she didn't know that already. Get this over with and take me wherever you're going to take me, asshole. She knew they couldn't keep her locked up forever. When she was free again, she would return here and retrieve the backup drive. She would have the last laugh. Near the highway, west of the access road, leaning dead tree. She would not let herself forget.
What were you planning on doing with this?
He said, holding the stick in front of her face. Near the highway, west of the access road, leaning dead tree.
Give it to that lawyer you sent the email to?
She halted halfway through her mantra, her eyes widening. He was one of them. Yates chuckled.
You didn't think we'd actually let your message get through, did you? No, I'm afraid Mr. Gaines will not be hearing from you.
It doesn't matter. When I get the backup drive, none of this will matter. Near the highway, west of the access road, leaning dead tree. Yates stood up and twirled the jump drive in his hand.
In fact, no one will be hearing from you ever again.
Near the highway, west of the exit. His boot slammed into her head.
Watch her. I'll get the car, Yates said. If she comes to, give her another kick.
Yates hiked over to the dirt road. It would get him back to the access road and their patrol car a lot faster than tramping through the woods. Before he emerged from the trees, he pulled out his phone and called his brother.
So? It's done, Yates said. We got her.
So it was Patterson.
Yep. And get this, she had a portable drive on her.
A pause.
Do you know what's on it?
Not yet, but I think we both can guess.
And her condition?
Nothing a few aspirin and a band-aid or two wouldn't take care of. We'll get things cleaned up here. As soon as I get back to the office, I'll check the drive, then destroy it.
You're sure she hasn't tried to contact anyone other than that lawyer?
I'm sure.
That was not completely true. Yates was sure she hadn't used Scholarian's network to contact anyone, but she could have used other means. Still, if she had, why did she come out here on her own?
I was thinking you might be able to use her for the upcoming session. She put up a hell of an effort trying to get away from us.
Is that so? Not a bad idea. Have your boys bring her to the barn and I'll meet them there.
Will do.
Yates hung up and dialed his office. Scholarian Security, how can I help you?
It's Yates. Put me through to Jennings.
Yes, sir. One moment. Jennings picked up a few seconds later.
Hey, boss, any luck? It was Patterson, all right. We got her.
Great.
I'm going to have Murphy and Howell take her to the barn, so they won't be back on rotation for at least 90 minutes.
I'll adjust coverage.
Good. One other thing. Starting tomorrow, I want 2 people on duty at the solar farm at all times. Set up one of the temp gates on the access road and have one guy stationed there and put the other inside the fence.
On it.
3. 2 weeks later. As was his habit, the administrator took a moment to check his notes and straighten his tie prior to activating the video call with his employer. The wall in front of him was filled with monitors, each presenting a silent feed from different news outlets around the world. When he tapped enter on his keyboard, the center monitor switched from a visual of a news desk in Tokyo to a blue screen. Out of the speakers, the soft dong of the ringing line sounded twice, before the blue screen cut to a live image of committee member Monday.
Good afternoon, sir,
the administrator said.
Good afternoon.
Monday looked at his watch.
You have 10 minutes.
Yes, sir.
The committee consisted of extremely wealthy individuals from around the world. There were supposed to be 7 members, but they were down to 5 due to the unexpected murder of one member and the ouster of another for breaking committee rules. Other than their wealth, the members shared one other quality. At some point in their lives, all had experienced devastating pain caused by the death or deaths of loved ones whose lives could have been saved if someone had had the guts to intervene. This idea of intervention was the reason the committee existed, its purpose. Their sole focus was to identify dire situations that could be made right if someone stepped in, and then do just that. The members themselves didn't perform the actual saving, of course. They were the deciders of the missions, the funders, the judges of those who needed to be judged. For the missions, the administrator, who served as the committee's chief operations officer, had recently assembled a strike team. It was a mix of highly skilled agents from the worlds of espionage and personal security. They had completed one mission so far, admirably. The problem weighing on the administrator's mind was that only one member of the team had committed to continue working with the committee, and that was due to the member's unique circumstances. If the man had not agreed to stay on, he would have been returned to prison. The others, who had no such stick hanging over them, had yet to decide. The administrator wanted to change that. Hence the call to Monday, who, unbeknownst to his colleagues on the committee, was the founder and driving force behind their work.
I would like your permission to hold a meeting this evening,
the administrator said.
The purpose?
A new mission.
Davos?
Yes, sir.
So, you did find something.
It's more what we didn't find.
Scott Davos, a billionaire entrepreneur, was a friend of Monday's, and would have been a perfect candidate to fill one of the committee's openings if not for the fact he was missing that crucial personal loss requirement. While he remained unaware of the committee, he did know Monday could discreetly look into sensitive matters in a way Davos lacked.
And what did you find?
Monday asked.
The woman, sir. Like Mr. Davos mentioned, there are emails and texts sent not only to Davos, but some of the woman's family and friends, that attempted to make everything seem okay. What we have not found, though, is any physical evidence of her being where she says she is. We have expanded the scope to places she might logically have gone, with still no luck.
It could be she just wanted some time off the grid.
A few days, perhaps, the administrator admitted. But 2 weeks for someone in her position? Not very likely.
What's your proposal?
I would like the committee to vote on activating the team.
It's only been a few days since they finished the Nevada incident. Should we be rushing them back into action so soon?
They're professionals. This is what they do.
Though that was true, the administrator's real motivation was born out of concern that the more time between the first and second missions, the more likely the team members would decide to never take his calls again. The busier he kept them now, the better chance he had at convincing them to sign on permanently.
The committee will wonder why this mission instead of the Lambert matter,
Monday said. The Lambert matter was supposed to be the next job on their list.
Yes, sir. I will be happy to inform everyone that the Lambert case is no longer an issue.
This solicited a rare look of surprise from Monday.
Explain.
I have it on good authority that early tomorrow morning, federal agents will arrive simultaneously at the Lambert Ranch and at their distribution centers in Fairbanks and Anchorage with search and arrest warrants.
And how did the feds get involved?
I really can't say, sir. What I do know is that their intervention comes at a fortuitous time, and that they are likely to take the Lamberts unaware. The terror and reprisals experienced by those who have run afoul of the family should cease immediately. Federal involvement had, of course, been the administrator's doing. The two men both knew it. Though looping in the government was not something they wanted to make a habit of, it had cleared the way for the Davos job to come front and center.
Lucky us, I guess,
Monday said. He leaned forward.
Send out the invitation and make preparations to send the team in.
Thank you, sir. 4. The next day, Boulder, Colorado. Ananka slept right through her alarm, through the repeatedly ringing bell indicating someone was at her front gate, through the squawking of crows outside her bedroom window, and through the buzzing of her phone all 8 times Shinji called her. When her eyes finally parted, it was nearly noon. Though she had returned from London the previous day, it wasn't jet lag that had kept her in bed. She seldom suffered from it, and she'd been in the UK for only a little over 24 hours, not nearly enough time to reset her internal clock. No, what she'd just experienced was the first decent night's sleep since waking up the previous week aboard the Caris Ivanis, where she learned she'd been recruited into an elite team of operatives by a committee represented by a man known to her and the others only as the Administrator. Oh, and there was also the small matter that she and most of her new colleagues had all been excommunicated from their previous professions. Since then, her life had been moving at a whirlwind pace. With the promise that their names would be cleared, she and the others had agreed to take on the job the Administrator presented them, and spent the next couple of days tracking down and rescuing a group of kidnapped school kids. That alone would have justified sleeping in, but on the heels of the rescue, she'd received a call from Jonathan Quinn, a highly respected associate she'd worked with in the past, asking for her help on a personal matter. Hence the quick trip to London, on which she'd brought 3 of her new friends, Rosario, Liesl, and Dylan. As with the kidnapped kids, Quinn's mission had been a success. At least Ananka thought so. The targets had been neutralized, but there was some personal fallout between Quinn and his partner Nate that still needed to be sorted out. That was their business, though, not hers. She'd arrived at her place in Boulder, Colorado around 7:30 the previous evening, and by 7:45, she was asleep. With a satisfied sigh, she rolled onto her back, thinking maybe she should spend the whole day right where she was. She could read a book, peruse the internet on her laptop, and if she became hungry, order food. She frowned. She would have to figure out a way of getting said food from her security gate to her bedroom without getting up. And then there was the issue of the bathroom, which she'd have to visit soon. Damn it. She really didn't want to get up. She groaned, threw the covers back, and shuffled across the bedroom to the bathroom. As she entered, her phone buzzed back on her nightstand. But now that her bladder was so close to the toilet, the phone would have to wait. After Ananka finished her business, she decided a shower would be a good idea. She was hesitant to do the math, but it had been more than 24 hours since her last one. She'd meant to wash off last night, but her bed had been too inviting. By the time she finished getting clean and returned to her bedroom, nearly 40 minutes had passed since her phone last buzzed.
Ugh, really, Shinji? She said.
Shinji was Ananka's personal information specialist. He worked from the comforts of his apartment in the San Gabriel Valley, east of Los Angeles, coordinating whatever she needed. The call she'd heard before her shower was his 9th one. 4 last night and 5 already today. Double, ugh. Well, he'd waited this long. Might as well wait until she'd had some coffee. In the kitchen, as the brown liquid filled her Emma Peel mug, she looked across the living room, out the large windows at the Rocky Mountains, and sighed in contentment. There really was nothing like being home. Once Emma was filled, Ananka carried her across the living room, pulled open one of the sliders that opened onto the deck, and stepped outside. A perfect day. Temperature 72, maybe 73, sunshine and blue sky, and the glorious mountains reminding all who saw them who the real boss of the planet was. It didn't get much better than this. As she took her first sip, her phone rattled in her pocket. She kept her gaze on the mountains and took another sip, letting the call go to voicemail.
No matter how long she lived here, she never failed to be captivated by the beauty that surrounded her. It was like she was in a whole different world, like she'd been given a special ticket to Earth. Her phone rang again. Are you kidding me? She put Emma down and pulled out the damn thing. Shinji again. She poked accept. What? What? Why are you calling me so much? Oh my God, are you all right? You all right? You're all right? Please tell me you're all right. What do you mean, am I all right? Of course I'm all right. Why wouldn't I be all right? Because you didn't answer your phone. Maybe I was sleeping. For more than 16 hours? Look, I was tired. You can't do that to me, he said. I thought someone took you again. It was a fair point. When the administrator's people had extracted her from a tricky situation by drugging her and keeping her unconscious for nearly a week, Shinji had had no idea what had happened to her. I should have checked in, she admitted. Sorry, I haven't been getting much rest lately.
It's okay. Sorry I was so whiny.
No problem, I'm used to it.
What is that?
Shinji, let's focus. What's so important you've tried calling a dozen times?
It hasn't been a dozen, it's been... Never mind. The administrator called and wanted me to tell you to expect a package.
The administrator? He called you?
He did.
Why didn't he just call me directly?
I don't know. Maybe he knew you were sleeping.
Ananka glanced back at her house, her eyes narrowing. Had the administrator bugged her place while she was away? She had systems in place to prevent that, but it would be worth doing an electronic sweep just in case. When's this package supposed to come? She asked.
It should have been there first thing this morning.
I didn't get anything.
You mean while you were sleeping?
She grimaced, silently conceding the point. Hold on. She set the phone down next to Emma Peel, crossed through the house and out again via the front door. Between there and the fence fronting her property lay a 6-meter-wide strip of grass with a stone path cutting through it to the walk-in security gate. She scanned the lawn for the package in case it had been tossed over the fence. Nothing but a few leaves and an errant pine cone. Farther to the left, another gate closed off the driveway that led to her garage, but she didn't see anything there either. She walked over and pulled the gate open. No note stuck on the other side, and nothing on the ground. Either Shinji had gotten the time wrong, or the administrator needed to find a better delivery service. As she stepped back into her yard and started to close her gate, she heard a car door open. She looked back at the street and spotted two men who had exited a sedan half a block away. They crossed the road and started down the sidewalk toward her house. Shinji hadn't been wrong after all. They were a mismatched pair. The trailing man, dressed in a gray suit, was a head taller and half a person wider than the guy in front, and had the barely noticeable bulge of a weapon under his left arm. The smaller guy was more casually dressed, in jeans and a green V-neck t-shirt. No visible bulges on this guy, but he was carrying a briefcase. One of Ananka's biggest pet peeves was people coming to her house for business. This was her sanctuary, not her office. Not that she actually had an office. One of the few things she disliked even more was an armed man walking down her street. What would the neighbors think? When the men were 5 meters away, the small guy smiled. Ananka let them approach another few steps before she said, "That's far enough." Both men stopped, and the small guy said,
"I have a package for you."
"What is it?" His eyes clouded.
I don't know. No one ever tells me what I'm carrying.
I mean, show it to me, idiot.
Oh, right.
He started to open the briefcase, but when he almost dropped it, he turned to his companion.
"I could use your help."
The big guy, who had been staring at Ananka, gave the small guy a sideways glance. Then, with what could only be described as bored reluctance, he took a step forward. Small guy said,
"Arms out."
When the giant complied, small guy set the case on the big man's outstretched arms and popped it open. He extracted a 9x12 manila envelope. Black and yellow striped tape ran along all four sides. He held it so Ananka could get a good look. She gave it a beat before waving him forward. "Just you." The courier brought the package over. "Did you try ringing the bell?" she asked, nodding at the button next to her gate.
"Several times. I assumed it's broken."
"Yeah, it is. Just give me the package." He handed it to her, said,
"Have a good day,"
and turned back to his partner. Ananka watched them return to their vehicle. Once they drove off, she closed the gate. On her way through the house, she grabbed a pair of scissors from the kitchen and returned to the deck. She tapped the speaker function on her phone and heard rapid tapping of computer keys and action music. Are you playing video games?
Oh, hey, Shinji said. No, I mean, well, yeah, just killing time.
The music cut off.
So, package or no package?
About to open it. I'll check in with you later.
Wait, I'd kind of like to know what's inside, too.
Was it sent to you?
No.
Goodbye, Shinji. She hit disconnect and sat back down on the patio chair. As she took a drink from Emma Peel, she glanced at the envelope, half thinking she should ignore it. But after a few seconds, she set the mug down, slit one end of the envelope, and slid the contents onto her lap. On top of the stack was a mobile phone. At least the administrator hadn't forgotten her previous work phone had been lost during the last mission. The papers consisted of printouts of 3 news articles, 2 photographs, and a receipt for an airline ticket with a notation reading, "Boarding pass on phone." At the bottom of the stack was a second envelope, which contained a Texas driver's license with an Anka's picture, several credit cards, a AAA card, and 2 insurance cards, one health, and the other for a 2015 Ford Mustang. Everything was under the same name, Sean Ramey. Ananka set the IDs aside and looked at the ticket. Apparently, Ms. Ramey was due to fly out of Denver to Seattle, Washington that very night. Ananka wasn't sure she liked where this was going. The articles were next. The first was a feature on a town in northeast Washington state, a place called Bradbury near the Columbia River. It had apparently undergone a renaissance over the past few years, transforming from a dying former logging village to a growing tech hub. Not that it rivaled Seattle or Silicon Valley or big city places like them. Still, according to the article, nearly 2 dozen, mostly small firms had made Bradbury their home. The companies were all, quote, looking for alternatives to the congestion-filled environments their competitors were mired in. Sounded like a nice place to work, like Boulder, only smaller. The next article was about a revolutionary new solar panel that worked at near capacity even when not pointed directly at the sun. According to a spokesman, the product also worked at the same rate on cloudy days, making it an ideal device for locations where traditional solar panels were less effective. The device was still undergoing testing, but all indications were it would hit the market within the next couple of years. The company was called Scalarian and already produced a popular, efficient model. But what's coming next, the spokesman said, is going to revolutionize the business. Scalarian was located in, surprise, surprise, Bradbury, Washington. The head of the company was a man named Kyle Scudder. Scudder plus solar equals scholar. Then eon for the cool factor, she guessed. The last article was from a business news site and dated nearly 10 months earlier. It was a typical PR release, announcing Scalarian's hiring of a woman named Natasha Patterson as their new CFO. According to the article, Patterson joined Scalarian from Davos Home Fortress, one of billionaire Scott Davos's many ventures. Though Scalarian was nowhere near the industrial force of Davos's empire, Ananka figured the CFO position would have been a step up. Patterson was clearly a woman with plans. Ananka flipped the paper over, hoping there was something on the back that would let her know why the woman was important. But no such luck. She turned her attention to the pictures. The first was the headshot of a man in a crisp black t-shirt smiling at the camera. He was in his early 40s at the most, and exuded a confidence that some probably found intimidating. In the white border at the bottom of the picture was written, Kyle Scudder, Mr. Scalarian himself. Okay. And? The second photo also had a name at the bottom, Natasha Patterson, the new CFO. Like Scudder's picture, it was one of those business headshots. High school yearbook, only in more expensive clothes and taken by considerably better photographers. Patterson was Caucasian, with long sandy brown hair tucked behind her ears. She appeared to be in her early to mid-30s and had that ambitious, I'll get it done aura Ananka appreciated. Ananka set the papers down and leaned back, thinking. The administrator had told her, Rosario, Liesl, Dylan, and Ricky, after they completed their mission, that there would be more projects for which his organization would like to use the team. She hadn't realized the next one would come up so soon. Did she really want to work for him again? She hadn't had much of a choice on the first job. Sure, she and the others had been promised the administrator would do everything necessary to clear their name, whether they accepted that initial mission or not. But given the nature of what the administrator had wanted her and the others to do, the aforementioned saving of the kids, she would have taken the assignment no matter what. To accept this second assignment from the mysterious committee felt like she'd be moving down a path that would become harder to extract herself from the longer she stayed on it. But would that be so bad? If all the jobs were about providing help where none was previously available, wouldn't that make them worth doing? For years, she had this vision of herself, like Marley from Dickens' A Christmas Carol, wandering the afterlife, lugging a chain even longer and heavier than the one awaiting Scrooge. Until recently, she'd been an assassin by trade, and a good one to boot. Perhaps doing some good now and then would remove a few links from her post-life burden. She picked up the new mobile and tapped the pre-entered number for the administrator, still unsure what she would say. "Ananka, I'm pleased to hear from you," the administrator said. "Sorry for not calling earlier. I was no explanation necessary. I had no expectations of a time. I assumed you'd call when you were ready. Did you look through the information I sent?"
"I did."
"Then I'm sure you've gathered we'd like to send you and your team to Bradbury."
"Yeah, I got that part. It's the why I don't know yet."
"Of course not.
The why is that we think there's something suspicious going on there."
She snorted.
"I didn't think you were sending us there on vacation. How about a detail or two?
Natasha Patterson is missing." That hit Ananka harder than it probably should have. She'd liked what she'd read about the woman.
"What happened?"
"I will be happy to elaborate, but only after you accept the job."
"Naturally."
"So, the missing woman, that's the something suspicious, or is there something more?"
Silence.
She took a deep breath.
"And I'm betting if there's indeed a problem that extends beyond just this woman being missing, and we don't do anything about it, people will get hurt."
"I don't know, but it seems likely."
She closed her eyes. Why, oh why, couldn't she have had a few more days hanging around her house before he reached out to her again? Gritting her teeth, she said, "All right, I'm in. Tell me what's going on."
"Thank you," the administrator said, sounding relieved. He told her about the mystery surrounding Patterson's disappearance more than 2 weeks earlier.
"The police don't have any leads?" she asked.
"The police are unaware of the situation."
"She's been gone 2 weeks and no one's called the police?"
"It's our understanding that most people are unaware there's anything wrong."
"Hold on. I have an article right here that says she's a bigwig at this Scholarian place. Someone's got to have noticed she's not coming into the office."
Late on the evening of April 5th, an email was sent to both Kyle Scudder and the Scholarian HR department, ostensibly from Natasha Patterson.
Ostensibly?
In it, she says she needed to take an immediate leave of absence due to the unforeseen hospitalization of a family member on the East Coast. She apologized for the suddenness and promised to be in touch. She has since responded to several work emails, but when any personal questions are asked, her replies have been brief and vague. Calls made to her mobile phone go straight to voicemail. No one has talked to her.
Then you aren't even sure she's missing. I mean, she could be telling the truth, couldn't she?
She could be, if we thought she was the one writing the emails.
But you don't think that.
We've been in touch with someone who knows her well. In fact, he's the one who brought the case to our attention.
Couldn't he be wrong?
His name is Scott Davos.
Scott Davos? The Scott Davos?
Correct. Davos has been a mentor to her.
Just a mentor, or more?
My understanding is just a mentor. About a month ago, she contacted him and hinted that there was a problem.
At Scholarian?
That's not clear, but it is a fair assumption. When he pushed her on it, she played it down, said it was probably nothing and not to worry. They have been in the habit of emailing at least every other day, if not every day. After this exchange, their correspondence carried on as usual until the night before she disappeared. When he emailed on the evening of the 4th, she replied within minutes that she would soon be sending him a present to mark the anniversary of the first time they worked together. Only that had happened in the fall, not in April. What this told him was that she was worried about someone reading her email. So he replied that he looked forward to receiving it and said it had been a while since they'd had a chat and for her to call when she had a chance. She promised she would, even going so far as to say perhaps the following evening. When the night of the 5th came, however, she didn't call, nor did she respond to his email as quickly as she usually did. Her reply didn't arrive until the following day, only instead of the usual message, it was brief, businesslike, and nothing like the way she usually responded. He tried calling her, but was sent to voicemail every time.
That's it?
That's it.
No mention of what she was worried about?
None. And the present she mentioned, I'm guessing it didn't show up. Not as of this morning.
Okay, I get that's kind of troubling, but how did he make the leap to assuming she's missing?
After a few days, she stopped responding to any of his emails, so he phoned her work number and was told she was away on a family emergency. But Davos knows her family. Her only immediate relations are her brother and his wife and kids in Chicago. He had an associate contact the brother on some pretense having to do with Natasha's former employment, and it was clear that the brother had no knowledge of any family emergency.
It could have been something else. Perhaps a friend who needed her help, or a personal matter she didn't want to share.
That's true. But Davos did as much as he could to locate her and found nothing. That's when he came to us.
Excuse me if I'm missing something here, but you gave me the impression that your organization was secret. How would he even know to come to you?
The administrator hesitated.
I misspoke. He didn't come to us specifically. He came to his friend, who happens to be a member of the board.
The board member was concerned enough to ask me to look into it. After a preliminary investigation, I concurred with Mr. Davos's assessment that Miss Patterson is missing, and the committee decided to activate our full involvement.
Meaning me and the team.
Correct.
5. The Great State of Washington. A delay out of Seattle meant Ananka's flight to Spokane didn't land until nearly 1 a.m. Except for a cleaning crew and a few airport police officers, the place was deserted. Thankfully, the Mustang registered to her new alias was exactly where she'd been told she'd find it. She retrieved the key fob from under the rear bumper, climbed in, and got underway. After her conversation with the administrator, he had emailed her a link and an access code that she used to download additional information. It wasn't much. Natasha Patterson went by the name Tasha. She was 34, never married, no kids. Other info included the woman's social security number, credit cards and bank account numbers, and her known habits and social media links. A second file provided specifics about her brother and the names and basic info on the three people in Bradbury with whom she was closest. Instructions from the administrator stressed, however, that the brother should not be contacted unless absolutely necessary, and even then only if the administrator cleared it. The drive from Spokane was mostly due north, through a valley that cut through the Colville National Forest. Ananka guessed it was a beautiful route during the day, but with the moon yet to rise, she saw little beyond the halos of her headlights. It took about an hour and a half to reach the Columbia River, and another 20 minutes before she arrived in Bradbury, though she was tired enough to justify heading straight for her hotel. Her professional habits would not let that happen. To survive as long as she had in the secret world, especially doing what she had been doing for a living, didn't happen by luck. She had taken to heart the precautions instilled in her by the trio of operatives who'd served as her mentors. One of those precautions was, whenever possible, don't sleep someplace new until you have the lay of the land. So even though it was the middle of the night, she wasn't going to feel settled until she took a drive around town. There was no missing the charm of Bradbury. The brick buildings lining the central road, Main Street, of course, all appeared to be well over a century old. Most had been refurbished, but in keeping with their historic roots, rather than being plastered over with ugly commercial facades. Instead of the old five and dimes and general stores and insurance offices the buildings had probably once housed, there were now trendy-looking cafes and coffee houses and shops, all clearly intending to appeal to the nouveau adults the area's tech boom attracted. About the only businesses that looked like they'd been there longer than a few years were a doctor's office, a shoe store with a neon sign that must have been nearly as old as the building itself,
and the office for the Bradbury Evening Independent, the local paper. On the roads surrounding Main Street were the old homes that made up the heart of the original town. Along the highway, just a few blocks north of downtown, however, things began to change. The first sign of the town's new direction was the Berry Business Park. It stretched off to the right, its buildings designed to pay homage to the historic downtown. Next came a housing tract that could easily have been found in Portland or Seattle, or even parts of Los Angeles, the home stylish and hip, in a mix of bright colors and subdued tones. None appeared to be smaller than 1,800 square feet, with several that must have been double that. These were the kinds of houses that would have been out of the average family's price range in a big city, but here they were likely affordable for most, if not all, residents. Parked in the driveways were Mini Coopers and Priuses and the occasional German import. Ananka figured that here lived the coders and the developers and the management who were the breath of the burgeoning industry. Another few minutes up the highway at the edge of town were two large hangar-like buildings, one on either side of the highway. At the entrances to both were identical signs indicating the buildings were home to Skalarian. She continued north, passing more businesses and scattered homes. Then, right before the wilderness crowded the highway again, she came to a road running into the hills opposite the river. Attached to a curved rock wall at the intersection were illuminated metal letters that read, Green Hills Estates. Down the road, about 25 yards, sat a guard hut and a gate. She could see the top of someone's head through the hut's window. Home to Bradbury's elite? Some of them, she guessed. She'd love to take a drive through and look around, but that would require getting past the guard, and she didn't think he'd raise the gate just because she asked him to, especially at this time of night. There'd be opportunity later to look around if a visit proved necessary. She made a U-turn and started back toward her hotel near the heart of town. Almost immediately, she spotted headlights coming toward her. This was the first car she'd seen since she began her recon of the area. As the gap between them closed, she realized it was a police sedan. She checked her speedometer. She was driving at the limit, but eased back on the accelerator anyway. Even then, she was pretty sure the officer looked over at her as he drove by. When the squad car made a quick U-turn, she was sure he had. The police car sped up until it was right behind her and stayed there. "Nothing to see here," Ananka whispered. "Feel free to pass me at any time." The words were barely out of her mouth when the cop car's rooftop lights started flashing. Annoyed, Ananka flipped on her blinker and pulled to the side of the road just shy of the entrance to the Skalarian complex. While she waited, she retrieved her Sean Raimi ID, the equally fake vehicle registration from the glove box, and rolled the window down. In her rearview mirror, she could see the cop still in his car, face faintly lit by the screen of a laptop. Running Ananka's plates, no doubt. "All right, Mr. Administrator, you damn well had better have my ass covered." Finally, the cop got out of his car. From his silhouette, she guessed he was almost 6 feet tall. He sauntered up to her window, leaned down, and looked in. "Good morning, ma'am," the cop said. Not a policeman, a policewoman. The name tag on her uniform read M. Harris. "Morning, officer. Are you lost?" There was a definite, "you must be lost because you don't belong here" tone to her voice. "I'm sorry. Haven't seen you before, so was wondering if maybe you took a wrong turn somewhere." At another time, Ananka might have said, "Is it illegal for someone you don't know to be driving on the highway?" Or, "That's none of your business." Or the old standby, "Screw you." Instead, professional Ananka smiled demurely and said, "Actually, I am a little lost. I was looking for the Collins Inn and Suites." Her response seemed to take Harris by surprise. "You mean the one here in Bradbury?" Fighting hard to keep her voice innocent, Ananka said, "That's the one. Your driver's license and registration, please." "Have I done something wrong?" "License and registration." Ananka handed them over, and Harris carried them back to her car. Ananka monitored the cop via her mirror as Harris sat in her driver's seat and worked her computer again. After a couple of minutes, she picked up a radio mic and spoke into it. This was followed by more computer time before Harris finally climbed out again and returned to the Mustang. "Here you are, Ms. Raimi." The cop handed Ananka the documents. "Head back through town, then turn right on Clearwater Drive. It's just past A&R Diner. Go a quarter of a mile. You'll see the Collins Inn. Can't miss it." "Thank you." Harris touched her cap, said, "You have a good night," and returned to her car. If things had ended right there, Ananka might have been willing to brush off the encounter as an asshole graveyard shift cop playing tough. But they didn't. When Ananka pulled onto the road, Harris did the same. Following her a couple of car lengths back, all